That's the record button. Have we started?
We have started.
So, this is the Meet for TeaCast. You might always start like that. Who knows?
And we're rolling.
Hello, hello. I'm Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
And I'm Falco. Rock me, Amadeus.
You know that's not true, right? I'm Elizabeth McDuffie.
I'm Mark Allen Miller. Welcome to Season 5, Episode 1.
Season 5, guys. And I would love to say, as we launch this season, and we're starting off with a bang, with a super special episode, I would like to say that we have some reviews to read from you lovely people.
But alas.
I would love to play a voicemail from one of y'all so we could have your voice on the podcast.
Alas, yet again.
So, you know, maybe you guys could think about doing that.
We'd love it.
We'd love it. You help us rise in the algorithms and you help your friends, family members, you make it more easy for them to find the podcast. You do a whole lot of good in multiple directions. And I still say the easiest thing for you to do is just to leave a 5-star review with writing. If you want to leave any other kind of stars, go leave it on, I don't know, Joe Rogan's podcast.
Good idea.
But for ours, 5 stars only, please leave a review with writing in Apple Podcasts. Then just copy and paste that over into Good Pods. You'll have just taken care of 2 tasks with the execution of 1. Very efficient and easy. I don't want to make you guys work too hard. What kind of writing? I don't know. Are you mad that everyone's saying summer's over when you know the autumnal equinox is not till September 23?
You know, I really am.
You could say something about that, because it is dumb.
It burns my britches.
Chaps my ass. Well, makes a bee in my bonnet.
Doesn't really, really...
A burr in my saddle.
Bum me out that much, but...
I'm pretty irritated about it.
It's weird. It's like... Still feels like summer right now, I'll tell you that much.
I will tell you what, our landlord hired someone to mow our lawn today, and the grass pollens were so high that my eyes burned and watered for 3 straight hours while I was reading submissions, so that was fun. So, and that's summer pollen, so yeah, it's still summer. I have proof.
Oh, you were reading submissions. For what?
For the casserole issue of Meat for Tea, which will be released on September 9th, and we have Le Cirque du Artistique Collectif coming up at the Divine Theater at Gateway City Arts with art on exhibit from Zosia Kohansky, otherwise known as Wishbone Zoe, and Chrissy Halland. And we also have films from Zosia Kohansky, Wishbone Zoe, Spoken Word, as always. And then outro followed by Uzi will rock the house.
2 rockin' live bands.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be great. And of course, this is all in celebration of the release of the casserole issue of Meat for Tea. Because a lot of people get super excited about the shows and say, how can I support you? I love the shows. Well, you know what? No magazine, no shows. The magazine is the horse.
Yep. Everything else is the cart, including this podcast.
Yep. The magazine's the horse.
Without which, no cart. However, casserole is the issue and ways to support us. There's lots of ways to support us, including going to our website.
Yeah, that's the very best way to support us. Everything is right on our website, which is meatfortea.com. There you will find ways to subscribe to Meat for Tea, which is a wonderful way to support us.
Very much.
To purchase individual issues, whether in physical print or in PDF form, to donate to Meat for Tea, although donations of over $100 should go to our fiscal sponsor.
Email us at meatfortea@gmail.com if you want more information about that.
Yeah. Or just go to gatewaycitylive.org. Yep. That's our fiscal sponsor.
And there's also Patreon, that you can join, where you
get cool stuff on our Patreon side.
Bonus stuff that's all Meat for Tea cast and Meat for Tea Cirque related and other.
There's a really charming conversation I had with none other than rock star David Yao about 12 years ago, I'm thinking. Phone conversation.
Yeah.
David Yao of Jesus Lizard and other fame, and he tells a very generous and very hilarious story of a time when he was on tour with Killdozer. And
you'll have to.
I won't give you any spoilers, but
yeah, you'll have to join our Patreon to hear that. But
my daughter Madeline listened to it, and I'll quote her. She said she laughed the makeup off her face. So if you want to laugh the makeup off your face,
yeah. Additionally, one other way to support us is you can buy merch at our Teespring store. There's links on the website, of course.
We have a sale.
We have a sale.
Like everyone has sales on Labor Day, right?
Yeah, for the whole month of September, if you enter the promo code CASSEROLE, see what we did there, CASSEROLE at checkout, you will get free shipping.
Free shipping, guys. Take advantage. You can get tote bags. I use my Me Teeny tote bag all the time. T-shirts, both short and long-sleeved, and sleeveless for women. We've got kind of some lovely, flowy, sleeveless ones. Beach towels, because it's still summer.
Yeah, and water bottles and mugs and all sorts of fun stuff. So definitely
so
go check that out.
So much cool stuff.
All right. Okay, that kind of covers all the housekeeping, as it were. So thanks for sticking around through that.
We've got something special for you. We bring you a live table reading of four voices, mine and Mark's and Giovanna's and author Richard Horton's, reading a piece from his book, Artist in the Underworld. And the piece is called A Long Moment in the South. Reads like a play. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. It's a sort of a series of linked short stories, I guess.
Yeah. I'd like to encourage you guys to check out his book, Artists in the Underworld. It's not a Meat for Tea Press publication.
Yeah, isn't that...
Published by our friends at
Human Error. Yeah, Human Error, Paul Richmond
Publishing.
And company.
Yeah, humanerrorpublishing.com, and I recommend checking out their books, and I recommend very much checking out this one. This, I'm holding in my hand, actually, Artist in Underworld, the 2023 edition by Richard Wayne Horton, H-O-R-T-O-N. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it from Human Error Publishing, which is better. You can take the ISBN, which you can look up at either one of those sources, and just give it to your local indie bookseller.
You can do the same thing with all the Meat for Tea Press books, too. If you go to meatfortea.com and go to our Meat for Tea Press books page there, all of the books that are available to be ordered through your local bookstores, we have the ISBNs listed in the description section.
Let me just tempt you a little bit. Here's a little blurb from our friend, frequent Meat for Tea contributor, and he's also been on our podcast, Joshua Michael Stewart. These are wonderfully crafted stories that are well worth the read. So take it from Joshua Michael Stewart. And Richard, actually, this is the 2023 edition of the book. He wrote Artists in the Underworld, and they went back in, and he tinkered and tweaked and tightened and battened down the hatches and all of that. And it was good before, and now it's just a shining gem of a book.
And it was a lot of fun to read it, and I think you'll really enjoy it.
I think you're going to have fun.
That's what we got coming up.
This.
Got coming up, like, just about now.
Special season 5, episode 1, starting off with a bang.
So stick around, and we'll catch you on the other side. Enjoy.
Catch you on the flip side.
A long moment in the South. Behold a map covered in earth. Texarkana from 1951 to 1957 is a railroad hub, a town of connections, borders, and layers. Layers underground, layers between present and past, poor and rich, country and city, dirty and clean. How could someone not be unfaithful? not go from being one thing to being something else. Here's an old clunker driving along a road in 1956. The driver is talking a funny language of hisses, verbal words, quiet whistles, and lip smacks. On the radio, Patti Page is singing, "Cross over the bridge, cross over the bridge. Change your reckless way of living. Cross over the bridge." Here comes a bend in the road, and the driver cranks the heap around it, lines it up, and crosses over not a bridge, but the mound of the railroad crossing. How many times in dreams have I arrived at these tracks and felt a sudden dread? In the front seat, Aunt Audrey, with her big brown eyes, smiles back at the kids like a warm sun. We've crossed, all is well. The heavy old car drops down a hill and pops gravel as it swoops into a turn. Uncle Ed, for that's who he is, quiets down now as he straightens out. He doesn't have to be crazy anymore. Soon the rock and red clay road, rocking road, rocket road, reaches the black highway to Texarkana with its old buildings cooking in the sun. There's a tree-shaded square, farm trucks, overalls, bald heads, great big watermelons in the truck bed. Get you one. How about some peaches? The gnats love them, so you know they're juicy. God, yes. In the background, standing under a tree, the Civil War nods and says, "I recommend them."
Dream of the Golden Lighthouse. It's 1951, and the boy is 5 years old. He lives in a house trailer near the Air Force Base in Lubbock. Today, his dad took him up into the control tower to show him the base. He pointed out the white cement runways, the trailer park, the commissary, and the offices. Near the foot of the tower, there was a dark metal bomber sleeping after the war it had made in Korea. It woke up and roared angrily like it wanted its breakfast. What would it have? A chicken? A rabbit? A little boy? It rumbled for a while, like steady metal rain, then began to move, to hunt. At bedtime, the boy's mom read him little golden books. There was a book about colors, blue, yellow, red, green. He wanted to eat the colors. There was a book about a lighthouse, a book about zoo animals, a monkey, a giraffe, an elephant, and a zebra. Listen as I read you the story of the Golden Lighthouse. One day, the little boy's mother took him to the top of the Golden Lighthouse. It was just like the control tower at the airfield where your dad took you today. The boy and his mother both looked over the handrail at the Air Force Base, spread out below with its square houses and white roads. It was such fun. But there were zoo animals running around the observation deck of the lighthouse, and they thundered past the boy and his mother. He held fast to her hand. With his other hand, he pointed at the animals.
"Mother, will they bite me?"
She answered, "No, they're afraid of us. See, they run away. Now stay here, little man. I'm going downstairs to buy a pack of cigarettes." When she was gone, the board started to vibrate. The animals were coming around again.
"Mother, hurry and come back. The animals will run me over."
But she was busy downstairs in the gift shop. The kind lady behind the counter was showing her many kinds of cigarettes. "Oh, which shall I choose?" Up on the observation deck, the animals appeared. They ran toward the boy with their terribly frightened eyes and their long, sharp teeth sticking far, far out. "This is a damaged book, little man. Remember when you tore at it and put the last page in your mouth? Ah, you've fallen asleep. You don't remember, it seems."
Dream of the Cowboy Ashtray. It's a little copper frying pan with cigarette notches, a cowboy souvenir bought at a roadside store in New Mexico. It has three wire legs with rubber tips like little cowboy boots. As Bobby falls asleep, he thinks of cowboys and Dad's suntanned fingers on guitar strings. The frying pan wakes up and stretches on its wire legs. It walks around, then notices him and walks over, bumpity bump, across the floor.
It moves like a little horse, the handle rocking up and down. Looking at it, he wonders if it's happy or angry. Three cigarettes have been smashed out where Beans and Frank's ought to go. It could be fairly pissed about that. His sleeping body tries to stir. The souvenir skillet looks up, peppery hot, too close to his face. Oh, look out. It's a fast little thing. He thinks he better wake up. Real soon now.
Wake up, Bobby. We're almost there.
It's 2 a.m. and everyone's in the car. The car turns off the highway and begins driving through Texarkana. The town's dead asleep. Dad rolls down the window and night air blows in and stirs the blanket of cigarette smoke the kids have been sleeping under. He jerks, throwing his cigarette out the window, then reaches back and slaps the nearest kid butt.
You'll be at Mama and Granddaddy's in a minute.
The car slows when it noses onto Spruce Street. Still half asleep, Bobby sees emotions as colors swirling around. The street is Looney Tunes. Up ahead, the lighted door and front screen of Mama's and Granddaddy's house floats out of the shadows like a silent riverboat, and the car pulls over. The two old people, both wearing glasses and night robes, come down the steps, and everyone talks in sleep-muffled voices as they get out, stretching and complaining. Maggie won't wake up, and Dad has to reach in and pull her out. He carries her inside, with her hot dreams spilling on his shoulder and her thumb in her mouth. Mama looks doubtfully at the front of the big house. She doesn't like Mama or Granddaddy. She turns to Betsy.
Come on, sweetie. You'll get to Betty Bye soon.
Mom's smile is like a needle through a stitch.
Grandma arrives on a sweaty bus.
I'll stay here at the house so Grandma can have the front seat coming home.
The kids get in the car and take a night ride to the bus station to pick up Grandma. On the road, the other cars throb by. When the car gets to the bus station, everyone gets out and pushes through the glass door of the station. Inside, they hear baggage bangs, zizzing fluorescence, and the crackle of a hamburger patty on the grill. Maggie says, Daddy, I want a soda pop.
It'll keep you awake when we get home, Skeeter.
I'll be real good and go to sleep, I promise. Please.
Well, I love you so much, I'll just get you one. But don't you dare spill it. She will later in the car.
Oh, I won't. On the benches, sleepers in farm clothes or in wrinkled suits and crooked hats start stirring and sitting up, reaching for their grips and bundles. They know it's about time. A door opens and a baggage handler looks in. An approaching motor thrums, ratchets up, then lets off as the bus coasts into the bay and sidles up to the landing with a hiss. Dad and the kids go out the door and stand near the bus, watching the wrinkled, sweaty passengers get off, sleep-doped and ready for a coffee and donut. A man in a brown suit with something terrible pushing up out of his groin gets off and wobbles past. He sees the kids and smiles, forgetting the thing that's growing on him, killing him. Grandma gets off, short and fat, with 2 vertical lines on her forehead above her nose. She looks like she's frowning, though her face is otherwise round and mild. She's loaded down with bags. She wears a cotton dress she sewed herself. The kids run and hug her, and she lets go the cords and hugs the stuffings out of them. On the way home in the car, she talks about San Antone. Bobby feels a trickle of something cold on his knee, and it's Maggie's soda pop. She's asleep now, and she let go of it.
Farmer's boating in 52. Dad picks up 2 farmers to give them a ride to the polls at the elementary school. Charlie says, thanks for picking us up, RC. He lights a cigar. Mama waves her hand and goes, shooey. Ed says, Stevenson's an egghead. Acts like he doesn't even want to run. Couldn't make a decision if he got the doggone office. Charlie goes, what do you think about Ike? That's a funny name. I would call it a Jewish name, but I like the fella. Sure did his duty in Korea. That's the truth. Democrats wanted him, though. Democrats killed our pigs. Nah, he's not a Democrat. They wanted him, but he picked us. Tell you what, I'd vote for Ike even if he was a doggone Democrat. I would, too.
Farmer Church. There's a church in the valley by the Wildwood. No lovelier place in the dale. No spot is more dear to my childhood as the little brown church in the dale. On Sunday, Grandma takes the three kids over to Ms. Hiles' house. Henrietta's getting dressed, so naturally they all go into her room and pester her. Henrietta pecks at her clothes like a chicken. Henrietta the chicken. She picks, pecks, picks up a dress with a houndstooth pattern. Houndstooth's gonna bite ya. She frowns, looking it over, jerking it. Will he look at this one?
Bobby thinks he, what he, who he.
The dress has a little summer jacket that goes with it. Henrietta goes, that'll be hot as fire, I expect. Grandma talks about heaven and what the golden streets might be like if she makes it there. But she's worried because she cusses sometimes. Her kids taught her to cuss. Then she talks about her first heart attack.
It felt like a criminal. I had crawled in my window and jumped on my back.
Henrietta says, that'll be rewarded, Mary. I know it will. Finally, they all go out and get in Henrietta's car with the kids jammed in the back, sweating and hitting each other.
Ow!
Move over.
Where to?
Grandma!
Settle down back there or I'll pop you one.
The car gets off into the woods. Betsy says, quit looking at me.
I'm not looking at you. I'm looking at a tree.
All right, one more word. Just one more word.
The car pulls into the clearing and there's a little church. Like in the song, Church in the Wildwood. A blue neon cross sticks up above the pointed roof. The preacher with white hair and a worried frown comes out to the car as the kids crawl out, damp with sweat. Maggie's grinning, hoping to see Betsy or Bobby get whipped. The old churchman shakes Henrietta's and Grandma's hands. Both hands, one after the other. He wears a black suit and square-toed shoes. Behind him, a young fella, maybe his son, bounces up grinning and gives a bashful wave to Henrietta. His Adam's apple goes up and down. Henrietta looks down and tugs the little houndstooth summer jacket that's cooking her in the spring heat. She tries to smile, though the frown line on her young forehead is already there to stay. The farmers in suits standing nearby have wrinkled red necks. Their wives smell like perfume and are noisy with gossip. Bobby drifts over to two boys and a girl in church clothes. They're suntanned and sweaty, and their hair is dull with grease. The girl, too, her thick braids dull. He can't tell if they'll say anything, but they must reckon it might be possible. The boys tell a string of preacher jokes. The preacher that swallowed a fly.
And hold on, here's one. Preach says to the mechanic, fill her up, Joe. Mechanic says, want me to check the motor, Rev? Preach says, no, no, that won't be necessary. The carburetor still carbs, the radiator still rads, and the pistons still, well, they work too. Killing chickens.
Which of you wants to kill it?
Let me, let me.
She reaches her skinny arm for the hatchet. Grandma gives it to her, and the weight pulls her arms down. The ground in the chicken coop is covered in chicken shit. Grandma unlatches the gate and goes in, pulling it closed behind her. The chickens come over to see what's the matter, and she grabs a young rooster who squawks as she carries him out the gate. Maggie holds the hatchet, grinning, beside the post. Grandma tries to hold the chicken with its neck on the post.
Now don't go and cut my head off.
Her back starts to give out.
Shit, I can't do this. Bobby, get over here.
I want the hatchet.
You gonna sass me, boy? All right, I'm tired of this. Now watch. This is the other way to get a chicken's head off.
She grabs the chicken by the neck and swings it around until its head comes off in her hand.
There's your Sunday dinner.
The headless chicken flops around in the dirt under the oaks.
Go get that chicken, Maggie. One thing's for sure, it won't bite you.
Maggie, making a face, goes and picks up the dusty headless chicken, and everyone goes inside. Grandma sticks it in a pot of boiling water on the stove. Right away, they smell the feathers cooking. Grandma picks up the broom and uses the handle to push the chicken down in the water.
Now for the fun part. You kids get to pick it.
After a minute or two, she dredges the chicken out and puts it on the table where Maggie and Bobby pull its feathers off. They get to watch Grandma gut it and divide it for frying.
A burned house. All summer, they pull usable boards and bricks out of the burned house across the road, pulling out the nails and straightening them, and going at the bricks with the hatchet to clean them. Now here's the dream that comes off of that. A board whoops up off the pile and two old nails stuck through the end and comes after Bobby like a snake with fangs.
You can't let them bite you. They got old house disease. Full blood. Grandma's trying to get the kids to go to sleep. Got to tell them a story, looks like. Oh, Lord. She reaches down and rubs her aching feet.
These moccasins ain't Injun moccasins. I wear them just because my feet are so swole up. My mama now, she was full blood Injun. She would let me comb her long, coal black hair that she never cut. When she let it down, it hung almost to her feet. I was 7 then, and I sure liked her hair. Mine was blonde because my daddy was full blood Irish. I didn't know what to think when that long hair of Mama's began to fall out. She was sick with cancer. She knew she was finished. She told me she was going to set out and see the mountains one more time before the cancer got her. I looked after her all the time she was in the bed. My sisters were little and I had to look after them too. They ran around and screamed and got in trouble. Later when we were grown up, they were sorry for how they'd acted back then. Mama kept saying she was going to get up and start walking because she didn't have much time. My daddy was off on his law circuit. He was a lawyer. I guess you could say a country lawyer or a frontier lawyer. He was out on the road walking his horse along because it was an old horse. That was in 1911. I love that horse. I always wished I could have a horse like that. That's him over there on the wall. When I learned to paint, I tried to recall what he looked like, and I bring him back in oil paints. Mama said her Indian relatives were coming to take over and care for her. They were mad at Daddy for going off on his damned old law circuit with her sick like that. Mama said, they're coming here soon, but they won't find me. I'll be on the road walking. I'm going to get up soon and go. I'll set out before they get here and stop me. I asked her, Mama, what do you want me to do? She said, you can comb my hair. I said, but your hair's half gone. If I comb it, the rest will come out. She said, sit here and talk to me then. 2-3 days later, I heard clomping and jingling outside as the wagons pulled up. Hand me that rag. I got to wipe my eyes. I'm through talking. You kids go to sleep now so I can smoke a cigarette. I've been cleaning this goddamn house all day.
Wild plums. The May air was an orgasming drug for the plum saplings, and so they had borne glad bounty. Grandma led the kids among them, far past the stripped ground where the burnt house used to stand. They followed the fat, gray-haired daughter of Oklahoma and Kansas Indians. She frowned, because she'd had bad eyesight as a kid, and her family couldn't afford glasses. Now she had glasses, but she frowned anyway because she felt like it. At first, they picked blackberries as Grandma told 35-year-old jokes, dirty jokes of 1920, that she'd heard from her first husband, Oscar, when he would get drunk and try to embarrass his then 16-year-old wife. She wasn't embarrassed, but the jokes really did tickle her.
I could stand him then. He gave me Lewis and Tom. Then he ran off, and I heard later he drank himself to death. Well, I had no life in Oklahoma, so I went down to San Antone, and that's where I married Pat. He was a sergeant at the base, an Irishman. He gave me Mildred, Margaret, Jean, and Bobby, all blonde-headed except for Bobby, who looked like an Indian. We loved him the best. It wasn't fair, but we kept doing it, and it spoiled him. Later, he got in trouble and went to prison for a while. Pat was the best man I ever knew. In the 20s, there was a name for a man like that. A man who can. He got run over by a truck when he tried to save a cat in the road. If I could find that truck driver, I'd tear him limb from limb.
Dream where the wild plums find the center. They're all out walking and they're lost. When they look back along the dusty road, the house is gone. They've wandered too far through overgrown farm fields, and now plum saplings surround them, all pointing upward. What's up there? A cloud. What's up there? Plums. What's up there? The sun. What's up there? The middle. Far away, a voice calls.
Street full of Caspers. Casper, the friendly ghost, the friendliest ghost you know. Though grown-ups might look in anger and fright, the children all love him so. Casper, the friendly ghost, he couldn't be bad or mean. He'll romp and play, sing and dance all day. The friendliest ghost you've seen. Mama and the kids are in town. Mama is wearing a dress which makes her look strangely normal. In the street, the marchers strut by. There's Daddy waving from under his Casper the Ghost outfit. The kids know it's him because of the old tattoo of an airplane propeller on his wrist. One of the Caspers pedals around crazily in front of the marchers on a little tricycle, waving at everybody and honking the trike horn. It's obvious it's Mr. Jeffords because a sign on his back says Jeffords Hardware, we're there for every little need. Bobby thinks, that Casper, he must be real religious. Them red crosses. Back home later, he goes to the backyard and sits in the dust under the oaks making June bugs get in gladiator fights with ants. When Mama sets out to go visit Edna, he goes inside the house and pulls the pillowcase off his pillow. He finds Mama's sewing scissors and cuts eye holes, then takes the pillowcase out to the chicken pen and womps it down over the rooster so he can watch him jerk around the chicken yard. Later, after Mama washes that pillowcase, it goes right back on his pillow, and it gives him a scare some nights when he wakes up and catches it watching him.
Civil War gun. David's house sits on brick pillars. Bobby and David go underneath and crawl around in the dirt. A chicken comes over to see what they're doing. Chicken tracks craze all over the dust. David waves his arms and the chicken squawks and runs off. There's a muddy spot further under.
That's there from the kitchen sink.
They crawl out and stand up in the sun near a chicken-packed watermelon rind that's curling up in the heat. Nearby, a couple of half-grown roosters are squared off, pecking at each other, with their neck feathers flapped out. David picks up the rind and throws it at him. Then he turns around and leads the way inside the house, bare feet on linoleum, past the TV. Bobby sees David's baby picture on the wall, his mama tinted baby David pink. Baby David's fat little face frowns.
I'm probably shitting my diaper in that picture.
In David's room, the legs of the dresser and the chair have red clay stuck to them.
Damned if I know. I think Mama found the furniture on the side of the road and stopped and picked it up. We go trash picking all the time. Anyway, let me show you something.
He pulls the top drawer open and takes out arrowheads, a bird skull, a rusty hatchet, and an old gun covered in rust.
This is a soldier's gun from the war between the states. From what I can tell, a captain must have carried it.
He lets Bobby pick it up and try to pull the trigger. It's rusted solid.
I'm thinking there was a big battle that day, out in the pasture. They made a charge at each other with their guns blazing, and the captain got shot dead. Then after the battle, they made a truce, carried the dead bodies away, and nobody thought to pick up the captain's gun. So there it lay for 100 years till Kenny found it last week. We took it to Old Bailey in his shed, out back where he keeps his tools and bicycle and bed. Bailey tried to hammer the rust off it, but it still won't shoot. Bailey said it was probably just some old no-account gun that fell out of a drunk's pocket. But it's got to be older than that.
Dream. Down in the mud, everything's all right. In the dream, Bobby is back in David's room. Pictures go through his mind. The frowning pink baby, red clay on the dresser leg, an arrowhead in an open hand. A rusty gun on top of the dresser where the veneer is buckling. David picks up a crowbar.
You want to see something real interesting? Grab that bedpost.
Both boys get hold of the bed and move it away from the wall. There are clumps of red clay on the floor back there. They crawl over the bed. David grabs the crowbar and sets the end between the floorboards.
These are all loose. I go down most nights. It looks like mud under there, but it's really a gate. Now answer me this. Have you ever wished you were a pig and could work your way down into the mud? And what if the mud invited you in even further, and you said to yourself, why not? And you stuck your head in, and it felt so good. So you pushed down further. And after a while, you came out the other side, and the sky on the other side was so pretty, and you just knew that where you were was where you should be. It was where you should always be. Small game knife. Kenny's sharpening his knife under the pine. He sees Bobby coming and says, Bobby, come on over here and let me cut your throat.
No, I don't want to. Shush, shush, shush.
No, you don't want to? Mind if I ask why not?
It would kill me.
Kenny smiles and shrugs in disbelief. But Bobby, what if everybody in the whole goddamn world came to me and told me they didn't want me to cut their throat? I'd never get to find out if this knife was any good on a rabbit.
I'm going inside the house now.
Damn, Bobby, damn, now I won't know.
I'm going in now. Shush, shush, shush.
Damn.
Dream, in which Queenie the dog goes communist. Note to dog lovers. Queenie the dog recovered from the dog bites she got from Bet, the other dog. She didn't become a communist. Now quit thinking that. Dreams are dreams. The man on the radio in the living room sounds scared, trying to talk quiet like he's in hiding. His words come like pebbles against a window.
The Reds have almost got us now. They're everywhere. They're walking into your living room right now, looking at the sign on the wall that says, God bless this happy home, and reaching for it to rip it down and stomp it with jackboots. Communists. They're sick with rage, mad, rabid. Rabid dogs, that's what they are. They're here. They arrived in the night while you slept. They came on transport trucks. Mad dogs. They could be anyone. Your neighbors could have turned in the night and decided to greet the dawn as communists.
Bobby's sitting in the living room at David's house. The spring on the screen door comes loose and the door hangs open. Chickens walk around outside, worrying the hot red dust, scratching and pecking. Edna, David's mama, is in the kitchen making biscuits. David walks in the door with the .22.
I almost got that rabbit, but he hopped just as I was shooting.
He falls on the other couch.
Woo-hoo, it's hot. Look at Queenie. She's so hot, she's about to fall over. Here, Queenie. Here, girl.
Bobby looks at the doorway where Queenie has just struggled in. A second look. Queenie isn't right. She stands swaying and red-eyed next to the screen door, strings of saliva dripping from her mouth.
Radio man says,
a new day. A new day as a communist.
Queenie ignores David, her old master, and takes a trembling step toward Bobby, falls over, gets up. The red meat of her right hind leg is exposed. She's too giddy to lick it, and parasites have come, maggots, come to suck the sweet tit of decadence. As she sways and stumbles toward him, he climbs up and perches on top of the couch back. She moves closer.
They move in for a meaningful discussion. That's what they say it is, just a meaningful discussion, pal.
In the kitchen, Edna pulls down the oven door. The biscuits look up at her, waiting for instructions.
Suppose.
Your granddaddy is a fussy, snooty man. He didn't want your mama marrying your daddy back in 1943. They all lived in a big mansion in town, and we were trash to them.
The big house?
Yeah. I had come up with your mama from San Antone, where your daddy had met her at the Air Force commissary. Your granddaddy didn't even want to let us in the door. Your mama was 17 and had already been married and divorced once. They were Catholics, so to them that meant she was ruined. We had walked from the bus station downtown and we were tired. The old man stuck his head out the door and said every blamed room in the house was taken by your aunts and uncles who were still teenagers living at home. While he was holding the screen door open, talking, I took my taped-up suitcase and turned around and started walking past the birdbath in the front yard toward the curb. And that made him shout.
Here now, here now. You just come on back here. We'll put you up somehow. Where did you think you were going?
So there he was yelling at us. And all the hunts, you know, have persimmon mouths, little pressed together and turned down. Even when they smile, it looks bitter. So there we were, moved into the house, but they didn't like it. When we took a bath later that first night, Mamaw told us not to run more than an inch of water in the tub, and both of us try to clean up in that. All the kids bathed that way to keep the water bill down. Your daddy wasn't due home on leave for another week, and all during that time the Hunts tried to convert your mama so the church would let her marry a Catholic, but she wouldn't convert. The old man said he wouldn't mind if we cleaned the house a little bit while we were just sitting around waiting, but he found fault with how I did it. Now listen here. I cleaned house for rich bastards all through the 1930s when your mama had to live in an orphanage because as hard as I worked, I couldn't feed my kids. One day, your dad walked up the front walk in his uniform carrying a duffel bag. The next day at the church, the priest refused to do the marriage. Immediately, the Hunts jumped on us and yelled, "No, no, no, don't get a civil marriage without God." But the courthouse is exactly where your mama took your daddy. They had to walk there because the old man wouldn't let them use the car. They came home married, and the Hunts gave them goggly frog eyes and made persimmon mouths. At the end of the week, your daddy had to report back for duty, and your mama and I were forced to stay with the Hunts for the rest of the war. I wish we could have gone overseas and got shot instead. Now, just suppose that a 41-year-old woman whose blonde hair had turned brown on its way to turning gray should decide one day to go sit on a park bench with a good view of the street and should wait there till she saw an expensive but very old car come poking along 10 miles under the speed limit because the prissy 45-year-old man driving it didn't want to waste gas. Suppose that when she saw this car, the woman opened her purse and took out a pistol, then waited till the car slowly turned the corner, then pointed the gun at the back window and shot a hole in it. Then watched as the car pulled carefully over to the curb and parked, observing all the parking regulations. Wouldn't that be a fine way for a 41-year-old working woman to spend her lunch break?
And we'll be back in just a moment. And welcome back.
In the year 4, with little corroded silver tongs, the old man dropped 2 cubes of sugar into his coffee cup.
My mother and I came over in 4.
He thoughtfully picked up a corroded silver teaspoon, paused a moment, and then took to stirring his coffee with it.
She was the best cook I ever knew. These biscuits are poorly made compared to hers. Now eat the fat on that pork chop, boy. If we'd had pork chops like that during the Depression, we would have cleaned them and polished the bone like a mirror.
The little boy sitting 2 chairs away spoke up.
What do you mean by 4, Granddaddy? The year 04, the year we left Scotland on the Ranger and sailed to North Carolina. Do you see this teaspoon?
He held up the ornate, corroded silver spoon he had stirred his coffee with.
It came down to my mother from her mother on the occasion of her marriage to my father, Brutus Augustus Hunt, in the city of Glasgow. The rest of the pieces in the set are over across the room in the silver drawer. Granddaddy, it's almost black. Yes, I've asked the girls to go easy on the silver polish so they won't scrub the silver down to the base metal. Is something wrong with those string beans on your plate? There's a bowl of bananas on the sideboard, and I would give you one if you would finish those beans. And that chop, what a shame to merely pick at it. Take it in your hands, boy, and pull it apart with your fingers till you've found all the meat. Waste should be a cardinal sin.
Mamaw came into the kitchen after Bobby was done and smiled at him through her thick glasses. Now there's a boy who did a good job on his plate. He heard the rattle of cellophane and smiled hopefully. Her hand was in her pocket. She brought out a handful of candy. Granddaddy smiled his bitter hunt smile to see the boy happy.
Mother, would you mind pouring me another coffee?
Dream of the Green Door. The song Green Door plays very quietly on the radio in the dining room of the big house with its long table, the dark brown varnish soft from the heat coming in the bright July window. Cicadas shish outside, far up in the trees. The house is shadowed, as it always is on summer days when Granddaddy won't allow any lamps to burn during the day. Though Bobby's asleep already, he yearns for a nap within a nap, but the dreams of day naps can be treacherous. He gets up and walks from the table, over past the stove, to the dark walnut sideboard. And there's the bowl of bananas, gold but spotted. The spots say they're drunkenly sweet. To his right is the doorway into the hall. He steps through it and glances toward the light coming from the screen back porch, and then he turns the other way, facing the dark hallway going to the front door. The quietness sings. After only two steps, he's even further with the door of a locked bedroom on his right. The radio back in the kitchen says,
"Midnight, one more night without sleeping. Watching till the morning comes creeping. Green door, what's that secret you're keeping?"
All the children of the 1940s are gone with their broken old dolls, dusty guitars that hung on the wall so long, model airplanes with balsa wood frames, and paper skin doped with green or gray paint. What's in this room that Granddaddy won't unlock? Does he unlock it at night to go in and bring food and water to a memory? Has the mind of the memory become so morbid and clogged with loneliness that the opening of the door causes it to throw open its jaws and shriek with joy as Granddaddy tries to shush it, until his efforts to quiet it are even louder than the jubilation of the prisoner? You know, you gotta watch out. Memories can do a lot of damage if they ever get loose. The prisoner goes running down the hall to the front of the house, bursts through the door, out into the night, beneath the thick, heavy trees, the sigh of traffic across town. Like a child deprived of approval, he runs back into the house and hunts his father, who stumbles in the dark and cannot see the thing he's released.
Things to do or not do. Leaves of memory unfold when the cicadas in the oaks cut on and off. Out in the road, bare feet have left prints as they ran away. The fan in the screen door drones to children who sleep on floor quilts. Beyond the crossing screen wires, rain clouds climb the sky. If you hear quiet bubbling, it's the beans on the kitchen stove. They're almost done. Things to do or not do.
Buried where the peaches fall. There were tornadoes in those days. When the sky tuned up, someone had to keep a worried eye for cloud worms. One of Dad's buddies in town told him, "Get a dead coop, RC, and roll it into a goddamn hole. When the sky looks mean, you and the missus and kiddies can run to that hole and get in the car. Go on a little drive, you know. Little underground picnic. Throw me another beer, will you?" So for weeks, the family dug in the peach orchard down past all the roots, deep into red clay. Dad said to cut one of the sides on a slope so the car could roll down into the hole and not just plop over on its roof. One day, the tow truck brought the 44 Hudson, and everyone busted a gut pushing its hard old wheels over the bumps and down the ramp, where it thudded into the far wall. Dad handed Bobby his beer, and Bobby finished it. 30 years later, After long searching, Bob found the old house built by Dad and his drunk buddies. The peach trees were gone, and he couldn't even find the sunken place where they'd buried the car. He walked into the field a ways. There was weak, pale dirt and patchy grass. The ground sunk under his heel. The sky looked mean. He reached down and dug with his fingers till he made a shallow, cool place. Then he put himself into it and thought of peaches.
Crapped out. Fresh night air from the woods creeps in the screen window next to Bobby's bed. Ta-hoo-hoo-hoo! Mama left the door open just a crack. There's the sound of a beer getting popped open.
Ran into Bill Jeopards.
Did he offer you anything?
Nope.
You put a sheet on and marched in their silly parade. Now there's nothing. Me and the kids stood there on the sidewalk downtown where people could see us. Nobody white will ever say anything about it, but some will probably look at us a certain way.
I know. Do you think I like it?
Hush. You'll wake the kids.
Mama's chair squeaks as she gets up. The coffee pot scrapes on the burner. The smell of coffee comes through the door.
I tried to joke with him, with Jeopards, you know. He laughed and asked after you and the kids. He said, R.C., you've been to everybody in town, haven't you? Been to the Catholic Knights of Columbus, went to the Elks. Some of our boys are Elks, you know that. You went to the Chamber of Commerce, Lord, Lord, the Masons. Couldn't get none of those folks to come up with a job for you. You're dying on the vine out here in little old Texarkana. I said, you could say that. He goes, now it's us, ain't it? And he paused a little too long. He said, when I look at you, R.C., I don't see a man that gives a shit about the white race in particular. If you'd have found a job before now, you wouldn't have come and rattled our chain now, would you? I grinned, trying to pretend it was a joke. Nope, I approve of you, though, Bill, all your charities. He said, no, you don't. I said, well, and to tell the truth, hon, I was starting to get a little twinge of fear. There was some deep woods mischief that went on a while back. Everybody knew about it. Certain folks got, well, done away with. Not going to find the story in the Gazette, but it happened. Jeffords was standing there looking at me. Finally, he gave me a slap on the back and said, I'll be seeing you around, R.C. Tell the missus I sent my best.
There's a minute of silence.
You quit the Air Force for this?
It's not a terrible town, sweetie. I love our neighbors, just love them.
But it's dead.
Yep.
All right, let's go to Dallas.
I'm with you. A bag of firecrackers, July 4th, 1956. The radio says,
oh, my love, my darling.
A veteran sits by the radio and thinks, yes, I meant it when I killed you. And then I return to my country, to my house, where I rested, where I sat often in a chair with the war medal beside me. The radio says,
time goes by so slowly, and time can do so much.
The veteran thinks, where are you now? Where did I send you in such haste? The radio says,
I need your love. I need your love. Godspeed your love to me.
Cars pull up to the fireworks stand out on the highway beyond the reach of town law. The city limits sign taunts the Smokies, who stop to squawk into their mics and watch the action at the stand that has bright yellow light cleaving out of its front to light up grinning faces. It's sunset now, but the fields are still lit in gold. Pull back now from this scene and let us float above things and decide what to do. We will go on a trip, you and I, and let the warm, heavy air wash over our faces as the landscape below us shifts and we come to a field where we can descend and become children, letting off fireworks, marveling at their abrupt eloquence. Here now, rising like a mountain from a plain, a new consciousness is born. A house near the field harbors two shutterways, a girl child and a veteran. Our bag of fireworks is empty. The wind takes it away and we hear desolate cries. We think at first that the sack sings its loneliness as the breeze turns it over and over on the grass beneath the tree. But the keening resolves itself. The girl child cries in terror. The veteran screams an order. Get down, fall back. Rise, traveler. You can fly above the tumbling paper bag and above the field where shrill children run, above the treetops and above the town that sits touching three states. A lone gunman 10 years ago took a handful of lives in the town park, and the police blotter became a storyboard for books and movies about the crime for the next 60 years. But only 3 years after those nighttime pistol shots, a storm of bullets raked the theater of slaughter in Korea and produced the veteran, who now writhes on the floor of a second-floor hallway, and who, as a child, once threw lit firecrackers in a field. As for his daughter, she's simply afraid of all things sudden. The veteran yells, "Get down, Martha, hit the deck." But she's beyond listening. Though he can remember Korean bullets slapping into the mud around him, he risks his life, gets up, grabs her, and holds her safe to the deck. The steadiness of his arms begins to calm her. After considering things for a while, she drifts off to sleep. In a soft voice, he says, "It's all right now. It's all right, baby. You're okay." Outside, kids run through silence. We are at peace now.
Swimming hole.
Grandma, can I go to the gravel pit?
Not by yourself. There's been a maniac running around loose. He could be out near the railroad tracks.
Oh, he won't get me. I'll carry my bowie knife. Besides, David and Alvin Lee are coming, and we got Jimbo, too.
Grandma limps over to the screen door and looks out. Alvin Lee waves at her. David throws a stick.
Go, Jimbo, get it.
Jimbo tears after the stick.
Be back by 5 so you can feed the chickens. I got beans cooking.
The three boys and the dog start out. The old dirt road runs beside the track most of the way. 2 light brown dust troughs with grass between them. Jimbo is jumping all over the place.
How'll we know when it's 5 o'clock?
Might be a whistle over at the plant blowing at 5.
Ow, got a sticker.
They have skinny brown arms and chests, except for David, who's fat and red.
Hurry up, I want to get in that water.
Bobby stands holding up his foot, pulling out the sticker. After he gets it out, they go on for a while more, cross the track and walk through the woods. The gravel pit, when they get there, is filled to the top with fresh, clean water, except for an island in the middle. There's a tree with a knotted rope hanging from a branch out over the water. Back when Kenny climbed way out there to tie it, he was grinning, pretending to lose his grip. David, Alvin, help me. Ooh, woo, I'm falling. And he let himself roll off and splash into the water. He came up grinning and yelled, "You bird brains didn't save my ass. Guess I'll have to shoot you with my .22 when we get home. Sorry, wish I didn't have to do it." Kenny isn't here now. He's off squirrel shooting. But he has a habit of sneaking up, so the boys think it's him when they hear brush crackling. It's 4 boys, about 15, and they say hi, like they don't hate the younger boys and have no thought of tormenting them. They roughhouse around in an innocent, nice way, and all of them jump in, splash, laugh, and take turns swimming out to the island. They introduce themselves, like church youth leaders, Joe, Tom, Jeff, and Bill. David and Alvin hardly seem to notice when Joe says,
"I'm glad y'all are good kids. White kids, I mean. I heard there were some colored kids around here that had been coming to swim. I don't know what I'd do if I found them taking a dip in our gravel pit. Did y'all see any come by?"
Then Tom, Jeff, and Bill laugh mildly and talk about the things they might do if they come across black kids in the woods. It gets so scary, Bobby jumps in the water and swims to the island, where he sits on the gravel trying not to hear. The boys jabber on, working on some real sweet childhood memories. Finally, they leave with lots of smiles and waves, and Bobby cautiously drops into the water and swims over to David and Alvin Lee. He climbs up, grabs hold of the rope. He looks hard at it first, swings out, and drops into the water. When he swims for the surface, bubbles tickle his face. What if, when he breaks the surface, David and Alvin have guns? What if a bunch of pickups are parked near the water with their radios howling, lynchers standing around drinking dopes? That's what they call Coca-Colas. What if he looks at his arms and they're dark brown instead of tan? That little bit of difference.
Atomic bomb of promise. Mom and Dad now have jobs in Dallas and already sold the Texarkana house. Grandma and the kids get on a Greyhound and ride to Mesquite, where Grandma is telling pioneer stories as the kids look out the window at the hot grass and trees going by. Hot, viral Mesquite. Kids on bikes scream, a town made of concrete, everyone burned brown. Take towels and flip-flops to the swimming pool where kids mow the water with their arms. They come home, slick-haired, slap on the ointment, ow! Lay your belly down on the cool tiles under the fan and the sewing machine while Grandma checks on the floor for scorpions.
It's me thereafter. They want me because I know them. Don't put a shoe on your foot without knocking it on something.
Grandma's sad old eyes behind her glasses can sure see what's scurrying. She says to the jack-fiddle scorpions,
I know your kind from San Antone.
Mom and Dad have been looking at frame neighborhoods, a row of house skeletons, rappity-rap, carpenter crews down the street trying to keep up, having to hire more workers. Here they come, cats. Big trucks full of equipment. Men up telephone poles stringing wire. Go! Go! Bobby climbs the skeleton of the half-built house and rides it. Dad signs the papers. $19,800. The family's in by August. The yard is catscaped black mesquite clay.
From now on, we throw away our scraps. From now on, we buy a new car every year. From now on, we have a dog. From now on, we watch TV. From now on, we bathe every night, and to hell with the bill. From now on, if we see a black person, we say hello. If we're scared or ashamed, we smile even more. That's what it is to be better off.
Atomic Crawdad. It's 1958. Even though this is mesquite, Bobby finds crawdad holes in the mud next to an alley and sits down to push a grass stem down one, waiting to feel the pull as the crawdad locks its claw on the end. It won't let go till he drags it out. Boy, is it mad. A car passes on the street nearby with its radio spilling a song. The driver sings along in a high whine, driving me out of my mind, while his cigarette hand clamps the steering wheel. Clawdad. It's then that the crack of whiteness hits, the big one, Khrushchev's shoe. The air turns rose, then magenta as the wind changes direction and sucks just temporarily toward the peak of dawn. He wakes 9 years later, lying on a foam rubber couch in Mom and Dad's Dallas apartment. They sold the house in Mesquite and they're getting ready to go back to Texarkana and become old folks. One of his arms has gone to sleep, pushed into the hot foam rubber. Bright sun comes in the window. But then suddenly the crack of whiteness hits. The arm that was exposed to the window has turned green and purple. Thumb and index finger have swollen into a claw. The other fingers won't be needed now and have dropped off. His eyes bug, looking at his crawdad claw. The epicenter must be pausing to consider its options. When it rips, the city is vapor. He wakes up in his rickety student co-op room in Austin. It's 1972 and he's not letting this one go. He yells and thrashes and falls out of the bed.
I'm awake, motherfucker. The day you knew. It's 1970. The returning sailor gets off the Greyhound at the Texarkana station about 2 in the morning. His hand grips the black zip-around bag that holds his civvies. He starts walking home. Cab pulls up.
Get in, sailor.
Oh, I don't need a ride. Thanks, though.
Won't set you back anything. It's free. You helped me out overseas, and now it's my privilege to give you a free ride.
Well, if you put it that way, after a few blocks, he sees his parents' house. This is it, right here. But the cab keeps going.
What was that? I didn't hear you. I was thinking of my own service days. Fucking World War II. I was home on leave, and it was 1943. My girl and I were swimming out to that swimming place where your mom and dad used to take you and your sisters. Only this was in 1943, when it seemed the war was everywhere you looked. Even if you were home on leave and you and your girl were just trying to have a picnic on the fucking sand close to the water, and you looked out and saw the wooden platform floating out in the middle. Remember that platform? Remember how it felt to dive off the side of the platform into the water? And one thing was for sure. You and your girlfriend were going to make love that night. One more time, before you had to board the bus for camp, then board another bus and another till you got to a fucking cruiser in the long fucking beach. The cruiser took you out further and further into the ocean, and suddenly, there was a sound like mosquitoes. Remember how you sometimes had to slap mosquitoes at the swimming pool? So me and my girl, we were sitting there on the sand when we heard mosquitoes. But it wasn't real mosquitoes. It was very bad men making a sound like mosquitoes. And they had broken into the park somehow, into the swimming pool area. They were just coming along the beach, killing everyone they saw. And, just as you did, we took hold of the ones who'd gotten to us, the ones who had grabbed us, and we held them. And that's when we knew, my girl and I, we knew. We knew we had them. They were not the killers. We were. You remember that day, don't you? That day that you knew?
American Songbook. I know not what I was playing or what I was dreaming then, but I struck one chord of music like the sound of a great amen. Out in the piney woods and cotton lands, the family in the car has been good and lost for quite a while, and the daddy won't admit it. The temp gauge on the dashboard's over to 3/4, and both girls are whining in the back seat. Daddy, I'm thirsty, and I have to go to the bathroom.
Hold on now, hold on. We may finally be on the right road. I know there are trees where no trees used to be, and the roads twist differently, and the grass between the ruts scratches awful loud against the undercarriage, like it's starting to be tree saplings under there. Oh, it seems scary just now, but I know where we are. We finally found the old swimming hole. Just a little bit further and we'll see it. There's a railroad trestle near where it is. How does that old song go? Long have I yearned for the days that are past, that again I might thrill to the hoot of trains that sped by when we swam. Where did we swim? How did we? But never mind. When we get there, you can do what we always used to do and just squat in the bushes.
Nancy says, "Ew, Daddy, turn around. I want to go back to the motel. It has a real swimming pool." Doris says, "And a bathroom. Mommy, tell Daddy to turn back." But Bob's not listening.
Ooh, that was a bad bump. I hope the axle's okay. I'm sure it is, but still, we probably ought to walk the rest of the way. All out for the old swimming hole.
Dear, you should really turn back. We didn't grow up in the South. If you need forgiveness for something, like maybe the Civil War or all the lynchings and shootings, I could forgive you. But we're scared now, and you really need to wake up.
Wake up. Wake up, you say, when we're so close. Why, there's a swimming hole right over there. I can see it clear as day. Come on, a little further. I'll pick up Nancy and you can hold Doris. There are broken things on the ground and the children mustn't tread on them. But there is the trestle. The passengers on the train used to wave at us as they passed overhead. Nancy, why do you tremble so? Ah, here's the shore. The pit's dry and dusty now, but over there's the tree with its rope. How often we grabbed it and swung out over the crystal water. But what's that? What do I see hanging from the rope? What dark burden? It was childhood I was after, but it seems I went much further back than that. Nancy, your trembling shakes my very brain. Dark, dark, why is it so dark?
He's in a bed, and his wife is shaking him.
Now listen, this is a mistake. We have to go back. We almost made it. If we could have magically made the water come back and forced the creaking rope to become something innocent, a memory of sunny childhood, perhaps. But now I'm awake for good, I suppose.
His wife looks at him with worry as he gets up and wanders into the parlor. There he sits down at the piano, reaches for the old songbook, and turns its time-yellowed pages as he drifts into reverie.
Ah, this one, I found it.
His fingers pause above the keys. Will he? Won't he? This is the deepest moment of the night. What nightmare, he wonders, might be released if he begins to play the well-remembered melody?
The Dream Bridge. When he walks to the bridge, a sign on the gate says, "Danger, no car or foot traffic." He always reads it and keeps going, over the locked gate and out on the planks. There are others coming to the bridge before and after him. They all come at night when no security guards are there to stop them. Like them all, he knows the safest routes over the rotten boards. Everyone has his own treasure over there across the water. So they all go out on dark nights, misty nights when water and sky look the same and time runs backward. They all know they shouldn't be doing what they're doing, but the treasure is sweet. Alive or dead, they'll keep coming.
Well, that was proof that I have gotten over a certain amount of fear of doing it. Live reading. Well, it wasn't live. It was recorded, but it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed doing that.
Kobe is editing in post.
Yeah, well, believe me, I was probably the most edited voice out of the four of us. So there's that.
Be kind to your friends with dyslexia. It's a challenge.
Yeah, it's not bad, but it's enough to create some.
This is the guy who does the layouts for my magazine.
Oh, I know. I know. Gee.
Anyway, sorry. Thanks so much for listening. If you're local, we hope to be able to say hello to you in person at Gateway City in the Divine Theater this coming Saturday, 1 week from yesterday. And if you're...
What's the date of that?
That is September 9th.
September 9th.
Which leaves only 30 shopping days till my birthday.
Ooh, that's a good point there.
There's your heads up. If there's lots of money in the spring store, maybe I can do something special. Wink, nudge.
Well, excellent. Thanks for joining us for the inaugural episode of Season 5 of the Meat for Tea Cast. And we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yep. We'll be back to every 2 week schedule.
Take it easy.
Ciao.
The Meat for Tea Cast is produced by Elizabeth McDuffie and Meat for Tea, The Valley Review. Visit Meat for Tea at www.meatfortea.com. Please consider going to anchor.fm to make a contribution through our contribution page. You can reach us through meatforteacast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message at anchor.fm/meatforteacast. We welcome suggestions for contents for the Meat for Tea Cast. If you've attended a Meat for Tea Cirque and want to hear from one of the bands or one of the spoken word contributors, please let us know. All portions are copyright Meat for Tea and their respective holders. Vote for Meat for Tea on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter at Elizabeth. Meat for Tea on Instagram. And on the Meat for Tea and Meat for Tea Cast Facebook pages. Meat for Tea is available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.